dubbed the caves by a wondrously creative fellow, whose name is unknown, perhaps thankfully for the sake of his descendants. This is a fascinating day trip for anyone who is interested in natural grandeur on the mammoth scale. The largest of the caverns could easily contain all of Manhattan, and are so high that rain often falls as the water evaporating from six underground rivers condenses into heavy clouds near the ceiling. Speaking of rivers, one of them enters the caverns from a 950-foot multi-cascade waterfall. This must be seen, and heard, to be appreciated. We have no concrete evidence to support any of the various theories as to what formed these caverns so many eons ago. The most widely accepted hypothesis is that during Corunda's formative years, an asteroid-sized ball of ice plunged into the soft surface and fragmented on impact, burying huge shards in a fan-shaped spray. The planet then coalesced around them, and as internal forces began to heat things up, the ice chunks slowly melted, leaving behind their enormous footprints for future man to look upon with wonder. And wonder we do. Further south is a feature that leads us to praise the infinite one that we were not around when it was created. Visible from 500,000 miles in space, there is the impact crater we have colorfully named the Eye of the World Shaker. About 800 million years ago, a planetoid of at least 250 miles in diameter came straight at Corunda. As it reached the Roche limit, it exploded and showered the surface with billions of tons of rock and ice. The core, however, was iron, and it easily survived the blast and the brief trip through the atmosphere. Estimated to have been at least 30 miles in diameter, it hit Corunda with a fury that to this very day continues to send detectable shockwaves through the planet, an echo that may continue for another 100 million years. The contact created a roughly circular crater 85 miles in diameter, and 4.8 miles deep at its center. The top third of the meteorite protrudes from the center of the crater like a grotesque eyeball resting in its huge socket, thus its name. The rest of the core vaporized on impact, peppering the crater walls with steel globules, and blasting metallic spheres as far as 3,000 miles from the site. The cloud of vapor and dust that was blown into the air spread around the planet. For 1,000 years it obscured Kaina's light before finally settling. All but the most stubborn life forms were extinguished. We look back now at this event, and try to stretch our imaginations to fathom those minutes so long ago, and end in a prayer of gratitude for life. Another item of interest on a colossal scale is the greeting. Many centuries passed, long before our people had developed spaceflight, we wondered at the stars that dusted the night sky, and envisioned travelers out there who might be looking for a refuge from their journey. In order to signal to these unseen visitors, our people, working with a technology equivalent to yours of the 18th century, undertook to build in white stone a smiling Corundian figure with an open hand raised in welcome. In order to be visible from far out, they surmised, it had to be big. They made it big indeed. From the top of its head to the tip of its toes, the figure extends for 233 miles. Its upraised arm is 78 miles long. Massachusetts could comfortably fit into its torso, and Rhode Island into its head. In order to make the shape clearly visible, the stone was laid in a line 2 feet high and 300 feet wide. When the framework was done, crushed rock was dyed and used to color the figure and give it substance. Although the figure used only half the stone employed in building your Great Wall of China, the task was truly a prodigious feat. Sadly, it was built on the far side of Corunda from Vrel City, and it waves its welcome only to those who make a special journey to see it. It would have been wonderful to have it smile to greet our guests. Obviously, comparisons will be made between the greeting and the Nazca lines in your nation of Peru. Let me say in response that the construction of enormous images is a very common practice around the galaxy. We have no information at all on the reasoning behind the Nazca figures, but usually these projects have some religious significance for the people who decide to undertake the task, and they are primarily the efforts of culturally primitive societies. In the case of the greeting, however, the sole intent was as a huge signal of welcome to potential space travelers. The builders made this very clear in their lengthy records of the construction. Our people wanted to say hello to whoever might be up there. They chose to do it on a grand scale, but then, that is the Carindian way. There are many lesser but equally interesting places to go. The Museum of Flight, mentioned briefly in part 1 of this world tour, covers 6 square miles with exhibits containing air and spacecrafts from the very earliest days of manned flight over 800 years ago. Over 35,000 vehicles of every imaginable configuration are lovingly cared for by people whose lives are dedicated to the freedom that flight represents. Most of the crafts are Carindian, but a separate campus of buildings is devoted entirely to ships donated by other Alliance worlds. Many flights each day are given in the ancient crafts, for the stout of heart who want to experience what their grandfathers' grandfathers felt as they watched Carinda slip away below them. To be sure, most of these oldies are still years beyond your present jet aircrafts, but to Carindians used to the security afforded by our modern disc ships, riding in these antiques is an adventure that is safer but no less thrilling than a skydiver's first jump. On a planet where risk is all but non-existent, anything that offers one a few moments of excitement, and even a smattering of fear, is welcomed with the avid anticipation of a 6-year-old awaiting the arrival of Santa Claus. However, you would not soon entice one of us to board your amusement park roller coaster rides. What you find stimulating would in all probability reduce us to white-knuckled catatonia. Facing danger is not unknown to us, but as for doing it for its own sake, we will pass on it, thank you very much. One last place that comes highly recommended, given our well-known love of things botanical, is the Tropical Garden, a veritable paradise for the devotee of the plant world. Within its 5 square miles are contained over 2 million species of trees, shrubs and flowering plants from 1,000 worlds. The most mundane are there, as are the most exotic. An aquatic section contains almost 300,000 different water plants. The desert display contains about 100,000 varieties of plants found in arid areas of Alliance worlds, including many that take their moisture from the air and need no external watering at all. Several hundred species from Earth have been included over the years, from the lowly dandelions and daisies to the most exquisite of roses and orchids. There are many other things and places that I could describe, but for the moment, we must move on to more important topics concerning your world and the many difficulties it will be facing in the months and years to come. I hope that one day I might be able to welcome you aboard a Carindian ship for the journey to my world, so that you might share for yourself its countless marvels. This is a goal that I and my associates strive for with every fiber of our beings. Help us, please. Valus, and peace be yours. I am RK. Next is, date of reception, the 21st of October 1988. Earth, a world in peril. Love and light, my Terran friends. From the lightheartedness of the last message, I must now return to far more serious and sobering discussions. Let me state at this point that what is to follow will in many cases be brutally frank, and it is very possible that it might evoke from you the reaction, mind your own business, alien. My friends, you are our business. The peril that threatens you threatens us. The forces of darkness are the avowed enemies of every one of us. It does not give us pleasure to find fault with the conditions on your world, but since many of these things are not of your own doing, we must try to bring you into an awareness of the problems, so that you might better appreciate the necessity of the steps required to correct them. To begin, I will address the most feared and debated hazard of the day: the possibility of nuclear warfare. I cannot emphasize too strongly that your people are not entirely responsible for nuclear weaponry. As I stated before, this capability was the dubious gift of the Omegan infiltrators who are in such intimate control of your planet. However, your race's seeming love of battle did nothing to impede the swift adoption of nuclear arms into your own arsenals of war. The force of the atom is a neutral thing. Of itself it is neither good nor evil. Used for the purposes of peace, nuclear energy can be an enormous power for advancement and abundance. We of the Alliance have long employed what you call the peaceful atom to supply unlimited energy to our society. On Earth, you have exploited both sides of this force. Many nations tap the enormous energy of the nucleus to generate electricity in a manner that, for all its considerably overplayed problems, is by far preferable to the prodigious burning of fossil fuels with their environmentally disastrous waste products. As I said before, the fission process is by no means the best solution to your energy needs, but it is better than the alternatives until you at last harness the immense power of nuclear fusion. Unfortunately, you have developed a very efficient application of the fusion process. You have named it the hydrogen bomb. Here your science was fully culpable. The Omegans provided only the knowledge of the military use of nuclear fission. The H-bomb was your world's native son. In matters of warfare, you are surely a creative lot. The principal reason that your scientists have continued to refine these fiercely destructive devices is that the Omegan program is maintaining your world's nations in a constant and unrelenting state of war readiness. Your invention of the fusion bomb was unanticipated by them, but they found it most encouraging. They would have ultimately provided it themselves, but your ingenuity only reinforced their belief that you are an ideal race to carry out their objectives. What, then, do we think of your peace movement? Sadly, we must say that we cannot agree with their naive solutions to the nuclear issue. It is an unfortunate but inescapable reality that the world's nations are split by fundamental ideological differences. As long as one of the ideologies employs oppression and tyranny to gain its ends, and that ideology is in the nuclear club, then those nations that have become the defenders of freedom and democracy must maintain their own ability to respond in kind. Remember that the Omegans do not create these political or ideological schisms. They merely enhance them. Also be aware that although the Omegans will seek to prevent a major war, they are no longer in a position to absolutely rule out such a conflict. It is perhaps ironic that the Alliance has in one way fostered this greater potential for nuclear war. By our efforts to wrest control of your world from the Omegan infiltrators, we have reduced their ability to prevent a third world war. However, before you judge us harshly, think well on what this represents. You have an expression, "the cure is worse than the disease," referring to the sometimes violent reactions of people to medications that treat an illness. Yet, for all that reaction, is there anyone who would suggest that the disease is better left unchecked, to spare the victim the adverse response to the medicines? The Alliance's medication for the Omegan infection is harsh indeed, and one might well object that there is no value in a treatment that might kill as surely as the illness. To this I say that wherever Omegan control is reduced in the governments of the world powers, Alliance influence is put in its place. Although we have given your people more control of their own destinies, we are also working to lessen the tensions that the Omegans have used to sustain international distrust and hatred. If we have given your leaders more power to initiate nuclear war, it has been balanced by reducing the incentives for doing that unthinkable thing. We will wean you away from your millennia of violence and bloodlust. We will give you a just and lasting peace with or without your approval. However, until the process is far enough advanced that total nuclear disarmament will not invite wholesale adventurism by the enemies of democracy and freedom, the existence of nuclear arsenals is a necessary evil. We find this state of affairs to be immensely troubling. Yet, we cannot support unilateral nuclear disarmament on the part of the Western nations, because the other side will not then respond in kind. Given the intense and long-standing antipathy involved here, it may well embolden them to use the arms disparity to launch a preemptive first strike that would cripple the West's ability to respond. Rest assured that we have seen documentation to that effect. Our support of Western nuclear arms is not without firm foundation. However, we of the Alliance are at work to eliminate this necessity. One should thoroughly analyze the unique phenomenon of Glasnost, the amazing ability of Mr. Mikhail Gorbachev to do things impossible under past regimes. What is going on in the Soviet Union is unprecedented in communist history. Why is it happening? How is it happening? Do you believe that the men in the Kremlin have gotten religion, or have become jolly good fellows? The old guard still exists within those walls, yet Comrade Gorbachev is apparently doing his thing with impunity. The inescapable conclusion is that he is, as you say, holding all the aces. It then leads one to wonder who dealt the hand to him, who stacked the deck in his favor. Interesting, is it not? My second topic is non-political. Although it is far less feared, it is a vastly greater threat than nuclear war, because it is taking its toll of lives every day without a shot being fired. I speak of the war that you are waging against your own small planet. Several times I have mentioned the seeming indifference that you have to the wholesale destruction of Earth's environment. Evidence indicates that the chickens are home to roost. The consequences of your assaults on your fragile ecosystem are now manifesting themselves in potentially deadly ways. We know that these things are the inevitable result of your actions. We have much confidence in this statement. We are not proud of this, but we once did this ugly thing to Corinda. Without elaborating, I will say that we followed your same general course of events. Profligate burning of hydrocarbon fuels. Rampant destruction of forests. Injudicious waste disposal. We did not pay attention to the warning signs until it became impossible to ignore them any longer. This happened when nature took those signs and beat us about the head with them. Because of the differences in our worlds, the effect on Corinda was greater yet. The denser atmosphere held higher levels of noxious gases and vapors in suspension, and our lower level of rainfall offered less chance for the air to be scrubbed of these toxic pollutants. You describe your problem as the greenhouse effect. It is a benign term for a very deadly phenomenon, indeed. For those unfamiliar with the term or its causes, let me briefly explain. Sunlight consists of a wide range of light wavelengths. A pure atmosphere is essentially transparent to all of these wavelengths. During the day, sunlight pumps immense energy onto a planet, but most of that energy is sent back into space by reflection and radiation, so that a balance is maintained. When pollution occurs, the air is no longer a transparent shell. At long wavelengths it becomes opaque, and heat energy that formerly radiated outward is reflected back to Earth. This is how a glass greenhouse works, and this is how a pollution-laden atmosphere works. Low infrared wavelengths, heat rays, emitted by warm surfaces are trapped, and the planet's ambient temperature slowly increases. Therein lies the formula for an ecological nightmare. On a world scale, a small increase of temperature might not seem terribly significant. But an average rise of as low as 3 to 5 degrees has a very profound effect on weather. This is not the place for a lesson on meteorology or the dynamics of an ecosystem, but this information is readily available from your own scientists. Suffice it to say that they will verify what I have presented thus far. The single greatest contributor to the greenhouse effect is carbon dioxide gas, created as a byproduct of burning carbon-based fuels. This burning may be rapid, combustion, or slow as in living cells. The key chemical reaction is oxidation of carbon. The CO2 gas, once in the atmosphere, is a mirror to long-wave infrared radiation. In a balanced system, the amount of carbon dioxide is stable because plants convert it back into oxygen via photosynthesis. This occurs both in the air through land vegetation, and in the water by CO2 dissolved in rain that carries it to the rivers, lakes and seas, and thence to aquatic plants. It is a closed-loop biosystem that ordinarily regulates itself very well. Enter the efforts of mankind. The carbon dioxide from natural processes is supplemented by the use of fuels for energy. Simultaneously, the green world is reduced through injudicious cutting, or, as in the Amazon forests, burning. Whether it is for obtaining wood or to clear land, the wholesale destruction of trees drastically reduces nature's ability to collect and convert CO2. Strike 1. Man's burning creates vast amounts of CO2, but also adds nitrogen and sulfur compounds that react with atmospheric water to create rather virulent acids. Rainfall then washes them out as acid rain, which in turn poisons vegetation and water, further reducing nature's filtration system. Strike 2. By carelessly disposing of waste products in the planet's waters, much aquatic plant life is killed, and the CO2 conversion factory loses more of its workers. Furthermore, dead vegetation and animal life decays with the release of still more CO2 into the atmosphere. Strikes 3 and 4. It is not necessary to beat this to death. The point is made. Of all Earth's animals, humans alone are able to destroy the world that they live in. We came very close to doing it. You are doing it right now. From the casual toss of a piece of paper or a drink can out of an automobile window, to the wholesale attack on your ecology that I have just been discussing, your apparent indifference to the health of your planet is truly appalling. We of Karandra are alarmed because in our history we went that same way, but we caught ourselves in time. The cure must be as fundamental a change for you as it was for us, and it is vital that you begin it at once. The technologies exist that will allow you to break this vicious circle. Learn of them and demand them. If you join to speak with one voice, your leaders will listen. For your sake and your world's, they must be forced to listen. The alternative is the death of Earth. A warning before you continue. I have thus far illuminated the physical aspects of the peril you face. I will now discuss the moral pollution that destroys your souls even as your chemical pollution kills your bodies. I shall pull no punches here. If you would prefer to live in a world of blissful ignorance, then read this no further. Erase the diskette, load or destroy the aliens game into your computer, and turn your brain off. If the above applies to you, then what is to come is not for you. The decision to address the issue of morality places one in a precarious position. The trend of Earth's modern society is toward situational ethics, in which there are no moral absolutes. In this bizarre, historically indefensible pseudo-philosophy, the morality of any action is judged solely by the circumstances surrounding it. Gone are the ancient and immutable laws of the Infinite One, our God. In their stead are the legal codes of man. The Ten Commandments? Who cares about them? This is the 20th century. Yes, this is the 20th century, and you are fast approaching the 20th street. We of other worlds wonder just what you will be by then, if you continue to forsake your moral and religious past. The 20th century seems to be a license for irresponsibility and amorality, a permission to invert every principle of righteousness, an excuse to reject your Judeo-Christian heritage as outdated. Where is it leading? The omens are very frightening indeed. This is a time when a nation's courts refuse to permit schoolchildren to offer a prayer to God, but allow them to be exposed to vulgarity and obscenity in the guise of literature, to be taught all the physical facts about their sexual nature, but none of the moral and social responsibility that must accompany it. This is a time when comedy is shouted filth, when a film cannot be successful unless the performers are naked and engaging in sexual acts, this including a depiction of Jesus Christ in that sordid manner, when television programming portrays the use of alcohol and drugs as socially acceptable and indeed very desirable, and teaches that the answer to a person's problems can be found in the firing of a weapon. This is a time when the champions of freedom vigorously espouse the civil rights of criminals, but have no compassion for the rights of the little ones in the womb, whose only crime is being inconvenient. This is a time when the sanctity of life is forgotten, and the meanness of spirit that engenders it permits the utterly unthinkable acts of abuse committed against children by their parents and guardians. This is a time when every known standard of music has been abandoned in favor of dissonant, atonal primitive rhythms, when lyrics directed at your innocent, impressionable young children advocate suicide, drug use, violence, hedonism and utter disregard for every social virtue that makes civilization worthwhile, when the musicians are seemingly intent only on competing with others for supremacy in disgusting, tasteless, talentless excess. This list could go on for several more pages, but it illustrates that the modern lifestyle is a moral vacuum. If an enemy of humanity desired to rid Earth of all that is good and noble, that foe could not devise a blueprint for action more effective than your way of life in the 20th century. a character of your comic strips of several years ago, whose name was Pogo, wisely observed, "We have met the enemy, and he is us. My friends of Earth, you are, in your misguided quest to achieve a perfect freedom, confusing liberty with license. Freedom entails responsibility and the wisdom to use it to the benefit of all. Perfect freedom is anarchy. There must be limits within which all live, or there is only chaos. Those limits are defined for all of us in the flawless laws of our God. In denying those laws, your people are inviting their moral death. Despite the errant claims of modern teachers and religionists, there are indeed many moral absolutes, unquestionable truths not subject to being interpreted or changed according to humanity's whims and social fashions. 20th century Earth suffers from an affliction of the spirit. It goes by the name of conceit, and its primary symptom is the delusion that mankind no longer needs to pray to or rely upon God. You, dear friends, are thus infected. You are trying to eject God from your private and public lives, and to convince yourselves that you are too sophisticated and educated to need the old religions. Poor, sad Terrans. How very wrong you are. You will find as you mature in wisdom and knowledge that your need for God increases as you grow. We of other worlds accept this without question. The Alliance, despite its technocracy and science, recognizes the existence and importance of the Infinite One in the lives of its worlds and its people. As long as you persist in trying to place yourselves on God's level or to dispense with Him and set yourselves up as His successor in the world, you are doomed to failure. God gives freely to those who accept and call upon Him. Those who believe that they can succeed without Him are offered the opportunity to try. God gives of Himself. But He will not force Himself upon anyone. We all have free will, to use wisely, or to use foolishly, at our own risk. Look about you, my friends of Earth. Do you like what you see going on in your nation and your world? Do you not see the unmistakable signs of a nation that has abandoned its God and that has been abandoned in return? If what you see is not to your liking, then it is well past time to take the offensive against the forces of evil. The Omegans are here, and they are doing their best to destroy your moral codes. However, only you will permit their efforts to be successful. A character from one of your films said, "I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore." The merits of that film aside, the attitude is one that Earth had best adopt very soon. We will do our part by ridding you of the Omegan influence, but we cannot bring you back from moral chaos. This must come from within each and all of you. You must reach within yourselves, and draw out the fortitude and resolve necessary to change your own lives if they are not according to God's laws, and then to take that message of hope and love to those around you. The New Age is a promise of love and light. The Word of God is love and light. The two cannot be separated. This awareness is the dawning of real knowledge, and the beginning of wisdom. There is much that I could add to this message. Your little world has problems enough for 10 more of them. But, we prefer to open your eyes and let you see the reality for yourselves. We are here in the capacity of lighthouses along your rocky shoals of life, guiding you to a passage through the treacherous currents so that your world might find a safe harbor. We will give you the light you seek. But in the end it is you that must pilot your ship toward the safety and security of your home port. The wind is now at your backs. Steer well, my Terran friends. In the next presentation, I shall endeavor to offer a few solutions, a bit of free advice, as it were, from us to you. For now, do consider what has been given to you. Your society, and indeed the survival of your species, may well depend on what you decide. Valus, and peace be yours. I am RK. Next is, date of reception, the 25th of October 1988, toward your tomorrows. Love and light, my Terran friends. At my request, this message has been titled Toward Your Tomorrows. In the next several pages, I will offer to you a number of suggestions as to what you can do to alleviate the major problems that beleaguer your little planet. You are of course free to reject any or all of them. We will not impose ourselves upon you. The purpose of the alliance is to eliminate the Omegan influence from your world. Once we have attained that goal, we will withdraw to act as observers.